will now come to order. Today is Monday, May 7th, and we are going to be hearing the Department-wide Support Services budget. And as soon as we hear from Ms. Baker, we'll invite Dr. Goldberg and company, Mr. Saiki Srijinger, and Mr. Pakaresh to join us at the podium once Ms. Baker has concluded any introductory remarks she has in terms of this budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Just wanted to call your attention to your schedule in front of you for the week. We are starting on the Department-wide Support Services budget, which is the name of the budget structure. They're using the name Administrative Services Division in terms of the organizational structure, so you will hear those terms interchangeably. We will go through Wednesday on this particular budget. This is the final piece of the big DHS budget presentations. And we will intersperse hearings on this budget. On Tuesday, we will have a hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2186 relating to set off of liquidated debts, and that's related to recoveries done by the Administrative Services Division. And then on Thursday, we will have a federal grant application request for you, and then the whole Department of Human Services agency wrap-up. And what we're anticipating there is that the director would go through the program priority list for the department as a whole, and then just briefly talk about the reductions options that have been provided for the budget. And then that will be the wrap-up for Department of Human Services. We may have a presentation in the next couple of weeks on the department's budget resheet, the repricing of the governor's budget. So you'll hear from them again on that before we get into work sessions on this particular budget. And then the following week, we will hear Commission on Children and Families and have public testimony on that budget as well. And that is the final agency in the Human Services Subcommittee for which you still need to hear the presentation. So as of the end of next week, then we expect that we will be done with agency presentations. Then we would be moving into work sessions on the budgets and hearing substantive or policy bills that have been assigned to the subcommittee. So that's what's on your plate for the next couple of weeks.
Any comments for the good of the order before we invite our guest up today? Thank you, Dr. Goldberg and company.
And Madam Chair, as they're coming up, I'd point out you have in front of you a packet from the Administrative Services Division, and this replaces the presentation material that's in the binders that you received.
Oh.
So you can toss the one that's in the binders and use this one instead. Well, it was easier to replace all of it than a couple of pages.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and glad to be here today. Folks have been kidding me all day, going to be uncharacteristically brief. What we're here to talk about in the next couple of days is our Administrative Services Division. And in many ways, this is really what makes the agency run. What we've done as an agency has been to centralize a number of the administrative services so that we can do a couple of things. Number one, we can create efficiencies by not creating duplicative personnel, budget, IT structures within the department. And what we've been able to do is allow our programs to really focus on their core competencies, which is service delivery, rather than to focus on the administrative issues behind it. So what you'll see before you is the arrangements of our Administrative Services Division, whereby we put together our facilities, payments and recovery, our finances, our information security, human resources, contracting and procurement are all done centrally. I've spoken to you before, most recently, at the rebalance around our reorganization of financial services, where in the department we've created two deputy directors, one for operations, Mr. Clyde Psyche, and another for finance, a CFO position, Mr. Jim Scherzinger, and we've realigned both our budget as well as all of our finance and accounting under Mr. Scherzinger, which has really created the type of administrative structure that I believe we need to operate. With that, I'm not going to say anything else except for one final comment, which is really to give you a preview about one of the things we're going to hopefully talk about in a few minutes, which is our movement towards process improvement, lean functioning, and some of the work we've been doing around looking at how we as an agency can bring more value for what we do, eliminate waste, create more efficiency. We've begun a pilot project within the department, within our financial services department, which I believe several of you are aware of, and we're hoping to roll that out throughout the organization. It's an exciting project, and you'll hear more about it in a little bit. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Jim.
Okay. I'm Jim Scherzinger, Deputy for Finance for the Department of Human Services. And in the, you have the handout, and right after Dr. Goldberg. And as Dr. Goldberg said, the Administrative Services Division is the administrative division for, as the name implies, for the department. So it does things like it has people, budget, accounting, payroll, HR, IT, collections, the director's office, those kinds of things. It pays the rent for the whole agency. It pays the state government service charges, and it does capital investments, and as well as a number of other things. Those are the major things. So as I walk through the a few pages here, it hits some real high level things about the department, about the division's budget. The first is the general fund budget. It's about $176.9 million in the GRB. The first chart shows how that budget is built, and you can see that it's largely the base budget adjusted for inflation. There are a few policy packages that we'll talk about as we go through the presentation today and tomorrow. The next page shows the other funds budget. The largest share of the other funds budget is certificates of participation to finance some capital improvements in the department. The MMIS system, the SACWA system, and the beginnings of the planning for the new state hospital. We also do have some miscellaneous other funds, other fund revenues, that fund the regular operations of the department through those sources of revenue. The next page shows the federal funds budget, and you can essentially, the administrative service division gets revenue from virtually every federal grant that comes into the agency to cover administrative costs. And so if you look at the sources of revenue there, you're going to see pretty much a split of how those revenues affect the department as a whole. The way that those costs are allocated is through a mechanism called cost allocation that I'm going to talk about a little bit later to sort of briefly explain how cost allocation works. But essentially what you're seeing on this page is the $254 million of federal funds that are largely administrative costs of federal grants that we receive. So to add all this up, the total funds, GRB, $485 million for the Department of Administrative Services. A little over half of that is federal funds. About a third are general funds. And other funds and general fund debt service, the rest. And then on the next page, it gives you the split by sort of the object code. And actually, it's pretty, as you see here, most of the department's budget goes for personal services, so the people that work in ASD, state government service charges, including the state data center service charges, that constitutes about 16-17% of the ASD budget. The rent for the entire agency, about 18% of ASD's budget. Some amounts of capital outlay, and then you see the S&S. So that's a very quick, high-level overview of how ASD spends its money and where it gets it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about facilities rent. It's not the biggest category, but it is a substantial category. This is rent in how many facilities in how many counties? Are we talking hundreds?
155.
A brief follow-up?
Please.
Is this rent in privately owned buildings? In other words, so some of it is state-owned buildings. Some of it might be cooperating between a state and a county or a city to lease some space, and then some of it is private sector
buildings. That's correct.
I'd be interested to hear your comments at some appropriate time about do we have the right mix of owned and rented or leased and collaborative facilities. To what extent do we need to be flexible and fleet on our feet, to move things around, and are we paying too much or too little?
As we move through this, and Fair Wars comes up to deal with that part of the budget, I'm sure he'd be glad to address that.
Thank you.
He's writing it down right now.
Thank you.
So
I think we're ready to move on to the director's office, please. So we'll have Clark come up.
Lights coming up.
Sure.
Right behind you, Clark.
<That's easy. laughs>
Chair Carter and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations for the Department of Human Services. And I'll be walking you through the Director's Office portion of this presentation. If you look on the first page at the very top, the purpose of the Director's Office is to provide overall leadership, direction, and administrative oversight for the department. And that's done through our Director, Dr. Goldberg, Mr. Scherzinger, and myself. We work with our program offices in the area of policy development, strategic planning, and helping to provide guidance and overall direction for those areas. The Director's Office also houses several programmatic and policy offices which support the entire department. Those offices are the Legislative and Intergovernmental Relations Office, Tribal Relations, the Governor's Advocacy Office, Office of Investigations and Training, and Internal Audit and Consulting. So on page 11, there's a brief overview of the Legislative and Intergovernmental Relations Office. The primary functions are to promote and coordinate our intergovernmental relations and relationships with stakeholders, policy, stakeholder advocate and advisory groups. The person in that position, Patty O'Sullivan, does a lot of work with the counties and many advocate groups that work with the department. She also provides information to legislators, follows up on constituent issues, and reviews management and program practices, recommending changes and ensuring that they are implemented. That function primarily happens when we're outside of the legislative session. Most of her work at this time of the year is taken up with helping the legislature. The other thing the office does, which we've just started to do in the last probably 2 years, is really make an effort to better coordinate and integrate our administrative rules process. As many of you know, we have a significant number of administrative rules, and they are handled within the program offices, and we made a decision in the last 2 years that we really needed to take a much more integrated and holistic approach to administrative rules than we have done in the past. The next page talks about our tribal relations office. I think we have a very good relationship with the 9 federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon. It was a high priority for Governor Kitzhaber, as it is for Governor Kurungowski. The department works very closely and supports the tribes in helping them provide services to tribal members. The person in this position really is a facilitator for communication between the department and the tribes, and also really is kind of the facilitator of policy and programmatic discussions that we have on an ongoing basis. On page 13, the main programmatic functions of the Governor's Advocacy Office. This was an office that at one point in time had resided in the Governor's office and served sort of an ombudsman function for the department, and a number of years ago was moved into the Department of Human Services. It provides a forum for Oregonians to address specific issues and concerns. And also includes a children's ombudsman function. Within that office, we also have our pain management function. We have a person who coordinates the Pain Management Commission, and also a person who provides services in the area of alternate formats and accommodations for under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we also, through that office, coordinate the DHS client complaint and report of this discrimination process, which also includes civil rights investigations on reports by clients.
Mr. Sankey.
Yes,
I've noticed several bills that have come through another committee that I sit on in terms of advocacy. How many do you, advocacy bills now that are requesting to come into the governor's office that you guys would take this time, and what, how many you have, and then I'll ask another question.
How many, excuse me, Chair Carter,
how many bills? I know one came through a committee, a couple came through a committee I'm on. How many other advocacy bills do you see that are out there that will possibly come your way in this office? And my extended, well, my second question would have been, how are you anticipating to take care of those within the framework of your budget you have now?
I'm not sure about that, Chair Carter. Maybe you...
We can get you that.
Yeah, I apologize. We can get you that information.
Dr. Goldberg, I think it's going to be interesting because I know a couple has passed, and you might want to take a good look at that before the session is over so that the legislature can be apprised of that, so that when you come back, people will know why you have a budget increase.
We'll do that, Chair Carter.
Good morning or good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you. Can someone tell me why the Pain Management Commission is here?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I don't know if I have a good reason for you. When we, when legislation established the Pain Management Commission, it really was an exercise of where would we put that within the framework of the director's office. And when we looked at some of the other choices we had, like audit and consulting services and the Office of Investigations and Training, at that point in time, the governor's advocacy office seemed to be the best place to put it. One of the things we've talked about is that within the governor's office, we may need to look at a different kind of a framework and have maybe a section that deals with things like the Pain Management Commission and some of those other department-wide functions that don't really fit well into these other program areas.
Thank you. It does seem kind of an odd fit. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Did I hear a voice down here? Senator Winter.
It's another subject, so you can...
Representative Kotek, that was a hard-fought bill with the legislators. And quite frankly, I don't, because a lot of people suffer in that particular area, and everybody was concerned about where it was going to go, but it is something that fits into the scheme of things in terms of that whole medical unit
of trying to bring down cost, and with so many people were not using emergency rooms but would have pain management available to them through many hospitals and clinics and that kind of stuff. Now, why it's there, I don't know how to answer that either.
But it's important. But
If I could add just one thing.
Sure.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, the one thing we did want to do was keep it in the director's office so that the person had access to both Director Goldberg and myself, because we know, as Chair Carter said earlier, what an important issue this was and what a struggle we went through to get this established. So we wanted that close connection to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question, at one time we had in the department, because of the volume and the need for volunteers, a volunteer coordinator. What has occurred, because I don't see anything in here in the director's office that deals with volunteer coordination, and yet it's something that we're always seeking to get more individuals involved in various aspects of the services that we deliver.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, thanks for asking that question. I actually got my start in the department as part of the volunteer program, so I'm very familiar with the value that volunteers and the enhancement in services volunteers can bring to the department. Unfortunately, as we went through our reorganization 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know how to say it except that the volunteer program sort of got lost in the shuffle, and we actually dismantled the volunteer program as we knew it in the past. Now, since that time, since Director Goldberg has come back, has been in the department, we are taking a new look at that, because we kind of see the gap that's being left since that infrastructure kind of went away during reorganization. And we actually are running a number of pilots to do a proof of concept and a business case to show the value that volunteers add, and hopefully in the next legislative session can have some discussion with this body about the value of volunteers and how the department could resource that volunteer coordination function again.
The value should be easy to determine, because we're actually talking about a body that's providing an enhancement service at no cost. And throughout our system, if we did not have volunteers, our budgetary cost would probably triple. And I see others that are shaking their head, so I actually encourage the agency to continue to find ways of making the volunteer coordination occur. I suspect that you probably have lost individuals who at one time were involved with the agency, but who are no longer here without that coordination.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, that's true. And again, having come up through the ranks of that program, I know the value they can add, and it really is one of the priority issues that we're dealing with.
Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't realize you're going off to another topic. I'm trying to go back to what Representative Kotek asked, and she asked a very good question, I thought, and you had a difficult time answering it, which, if I was sitting where you are, I have a difficult time answering, and the reason being that we have sort of a hodgepodge way of looking at health care in this state. We have no place to put these things, so we try to sort of wedge them in wherever we can. The bigger question really is, has it been an effective commission? Has it changed how we take care of pain in this state? I'd offer it probably haven't done. It hasn't been very effective, because it's sitting in situations where it can't be. I'm going to go back to an old theme here. We need health care reform in the state. We need a method an agency that really takes care of health care, whether you're talking about insurance mandate or certificate of need or what kind of care we're delivering, or whether or not asthma is being taken care of properly, or congestive heart failure, or pain management. We don't have any way of doing that. It's a hodgepodge, and that's why it looks so strange to you. It's a good question. I mean, it's obviously like, what's it doing here? The next question is, where would you put it? We've got two bills coming out to try to answer that question. Try to put in one place, in a reasonable way, in a manageable way, a board that will be looking at these issues, and then these things will be placed under that board so we can even really make some effect of how healthcare is managed in the state. And when you want to do something, you want to change something, the legislature can go ahead and pass something that would go to that board to be implemented. Because right now, you know, and I know, these things don't work very well the way we're doing it. Is there a need for change in how we manage pain? Yeah, probably is. And has this commission been effective? Well, marginally. But they could be a lot more effective if they're working under a health care trust board that could do the job. So that's why we have great hope for 329. I appreciate you bringing that up. It illustrates extremely well why we need to make a change. Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me get on my soapbox for a few minutes.
Yes. Senator Marsha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the other hand, the Pain Commission works extremely well. I've been to a number of meetings. They have required pain education from a number of providers, including dentists, including acupuncturists. They persuaded physicians to actually prescribe pain medication because there are those people who are afraid to prescribe pain medication. I'm not on the Pain Commission, Senator Mona Sanderson is, but I've attended a number of the meetings because this is something that I remember it was a difficult bill to pass. Now, would it benefit being under a different board? Maybe, but I just want to, you know, say my opinion is that they're doing a great job. So, just a balance.
Chair Carter, Senator Morsat, I think the Pain Commission has done some good things. Could they be more effective, and could their mission be better served by a different organizational structure? Possibly, and I think that's one of the things worth exploring. But I would agree with you. They've done some good things since its inception. Moving on to the Office of Investigations and Training.
Madam Chair, before you do that, I was just going to get in the queue.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
That's quite all right.
Please do. I'm sorry.
Can you help me better understand the relationship between the governor's advocacy office, as it is here in the director's office structure, and the governor's ombudsman. Where's the relationship?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, I think there's a lot of interaction between the two offices, and they're frequently in contact with each other and get referrals back and forth from each other. Our office, the Governor's Advocacy Office, although it's that's the title of the office, is really exists to follow up and provide services to DHS clients and programs rather than kind of a statewide programs or agencies. It's really focused internally on DHS, but I know there's a lot of interaction, referrals back and forth, and in talking between the two.
Within that interaction, if I may follow up,
please do.
Is there confusion on the part of the public who are trying to access
this is something you know about
a state agency with a concern or a question? Is there confusion about what people are accessing?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, I would imagine there is some confusion. How much? I just don't know off the top of my head, but I can certainly talk to our office and find out how many times, the frequency of the times that they get calls and they're not related to DHS. One of the things I know that's we're really diligent about doing, though, is if we get those calls, we make sure that we provide the person with the information they need so they can pursue their concern or their question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my past work, I would refer a lot of people to the advocacy office, and one of the reasons I would do that is because I know that they'd have access. If, for example, a parent was having difficulty, they could call and then they could access the file. But I've never really had a good sense of what's happened after I sent people there. Do they do regular reports in terms of the number of calls they receive, the outcome of those calls? Is that a document that's public regularly?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotak, they do. How much detail is in the reports is kind of, we have to be careful because of confidentiality rules and
regulations. They do regularly publish how many calls they get, what they followed up on. We track very closely what areas the calls are coming in on, or the concerns or the questions. And we do that not just on a statewide level, but also kind of on a geographic level. And we look for trends to see if in, within a certain area we're getting the same type of call or concern or question, then that would lead us to kind of dig a little bit deeper and say, why does this one area seem to have a particular problem, and what do we do to kind of fix it so we don't get the calls in the first place?
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because it doesn't make any sense to receive them and not look for trends. So no,
absolutely. The next area is the Office of Investigations and Training. This used to reside in our health services cluster, as we called it at that point in time. And now what we've decided is that we, I think we're doing it in this session, is we're moving them into the director's office. This is an office that investigates client abuse in the mental health and developmental disability arenas. And we wanted them to be part of the director's office, number one, because then it gives them a certain amount of autonomy. It didn't seem to make much sense to have an office that investigates claims of abuse situated in that program area. And the other reason we moved them is because this is a real priority for both Director Goldberg and myself. Client safety is one of the issues that's a real priority for us. We take very seriously. And having them in the director's office just really strengthens that connection and sends a message that this is a really important function. The other thing that they do, besides direct investigation, they also have a training function which trains investigators out in the counties. And they do yearly in-services and trainings to train the county investigators so that they can do a better job in the areas that they're charged with investigating.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have enough capacity to provide the training that is required?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, that's one of the areas that we struggle with. I just met with our office administrator, Eva Kutas, and her training manager, Rana McCarthy, the other day. And I have pledged in this next biennium to find additional resources for them within existing resources to strengthen that training function, because I think it's very critical that we have consistencies, a consistent way that people are investigating, and also I'm committed to trying to improve the quality of the investigations that are being done. So we met yesterday and we're working on a plan to increase that training capacity over the next biennium.
Follow-up, it would be helpful if you could be very descriptive, if not now, later in the report, in letting us know where the, I'm going to call them training gaps, or where the challenges are.
Right.
Because training, as Senator Winters points out to consistently, it's so critical. It's so
sure.
Key. And where you don't have capacity, we need to know that.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, they actually prepared a very good document for me that we went over the other day that I would be happy to share with the committee, that talks about what training is being done now, where the gaps are, what the priorities are, and what it would take to provide that training. And I'd be happy to share that with the committee.
And finally, Madam Chair,
Senator,
we need to be clear, as Ways and Means members, how much capacity we're investing in through the co-chair's budget versus investments in the governor's budget. And that's just training across the board in all of the DHS programs. I'm very concerned about that.
Dr. Goldberg and I was talking this before, and Doctor, before we finish your budget, what I'd like to do is have a report from you in terms of how well we're doing with having consistency across the state and that whole cultural
coming up in a few minutes.
Very good. That's exactly what I want to hear, because I think that there are too many inconsistencies statewide in terms of the cultural values and norms of the department. Thank you.
Please.
Finally, our internal audit and consulting shop. We think this is a very important function in the department. Well, Director Goldberg has spoken to you numerous times about accountability and transparency, and having a strong internal audit function is one way to achieve that accountability and transparency. We, for one thing, are experiencing increased scrutiny by the federal government in the area of Medicaid expenditures, and I think it's very important that we be confident that we have our house in order on the Medicaid side, and if not, know where the gaps are and know how to fix them and fix them as quickly as possible. And one way we can do that is through this internal audit function. They perform financial reviews, internal audits. When we have concerns about providers, we send them out to do provider audits, and also working with our branches to strengthen internal controls to prevent fraud or waste or abuse. And I can't stress enough how important this function is and really the value that they've added to the department over the past two or three biennia. Finally, the one policy option package.
Senator Winters?
No, it's not good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the topic of internal audit and consulting, some weeks ago we heard a presentation, I can't remember which one it was, but it included a policy option package to expand their auditing function for the purpose of cost recovery around overpayments or just incorrect things, and it sounds like they had a really good handle on how to make improvements there. We heard another presentation just within the last few weeks, more recently, where they mentioned that there are some overpayments, but they don't really collect all the money. So an internal audit and consulting function in the director's office, does that mean some of these other things would be brought into the director's office, or the director's office would just be more proactive going out to those other offices to make sure they're doing everything they can? I don't understand the linkage between this and the other separate initiatives.
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, we actually have an Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, which is situated within the Administrative Services section of the department, and you'll be hearing a presentation from them later in the presentation. And really, their function, their whole business is overpayment recovery. They work very closely with the internal audit shop. And Tricia Baxter, who is the administrator, will be making a presentation to you, and she will probably be much better prepared to kind of talk to you about that linkage and how that all fits together and works than I am. So if I could ask your patience, it will be coming up later in the presentation.
Certainly. Thank you.
You bet. So finally, on the last page of the director's office presentation, we had a policy option package which was funded in the governor's recommended budget, is not funded in the co-chair's budget, and the request was to add some additional resources to internal auditing. Particularly, one of the positions was a information technology auditor, which we do not have that expertise right now. And with the number of new systems coming on board and with the whole issue we face around information security, it's some expertise we would like to build in-house and really be able to have the capacity to better audit our information systems, both for effectiveness, efficiency, and for security.
Madam Gerard, and then Senator
Gordley. Madam Chair, we've sat here for a couple of months and listening to all the very badly needed services that the people need. And when I look at this, for $5.5 million, to make, and I'm referring to POP 106-59. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead of
you. I'm sorry, Chair Carter, Representative Gerard. I'm on POP 106-60.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I'll wait and reserve my comments.
Okay.
But you just got me warmed up about it.
Well, I know that Mr. Scherzinger is going to talk about 106.59, and he can't wait to hear your comments.
Oh, I'll bet you he can. My apologies.
Not a problem.
Senator Montgomery?
Thank you. I would like some clarification looking at the policy option package 106.60 and looking at that paragraph there that ends with the sentence, due to the lack of auditing resources, the department is unable to address areas of risk that could contribute to issues for the department. Can you tell us what you're saying there? What does that mean?
Chair Carter, Representative Gordley, every year we develop an auditing plan, and what that entails, or a risk assessment, excuse me, which leads to an auditing plan. What that entails is our internal audit staff meeting with the executive teams of each of our divisions to identify risks that they see as far as their operation. And we go through a process of bringing all those risks together and then prioritizing those risks, because we only have a set amount of auditing resource to address those risks. And so there's always a line we have to draw that says, for this upcoming year, if it's above the line, it's in the audit plan, and these are going to be addressed. And if we can get down further, we will certainly do that, but we may not be able to. And I think that's what that's referring to. It's really kind of prioritizing the risks and saying, with the resources we have, these are the areas we're going to look into and audit. And of course, if there's an immediate need that arises during the course of the year, that tends to kind of bump things on the list also.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like some clarity around how the increasing the internal audit capacity would mesh in with the reorganization that you're going through right now. I mean, it would seem from my experience with this process that there's no shortage of areas of concern that have been brought forward as a result of the review that's been going on, and that there is kind of a piece on the side of that, or a continuation of that process, that's moving into a discussion of redesigning the systems to take care of the deficiencies that were identified. So how do these people fit into that overall plan?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, are you referring to sort of the work that Mr. Scherzinger and the Financial Services Unit is doing around lean reorganization?
Mm-hmm.
I think and he's going to present next. Mr. Scherzinger is prepared to kind of talk about how that all fits together. So I'll just leave that with him, since he's been involved with that on a day-to-day basis.
Okay.
Get in line.
One question, and how did you get right to her? Because I think you go next, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, she does.
So, Mr. Psyche, what happens in terms of this shortfall that you're having as it relates to human resource? What would happen? Give us an example of what could happen that you would not know about until after it has happened if you don't have this position.
One of the things in an organization like ours, and these are some of the things that I think the work that Mr. Scherzinger is doing is pointing out, over a period of time, a practice can develop in a certain fiscal or program area in which, for instance, people may decide that it's appropriate to charge something off to a certain federal program or to Medicaid or that type of thing. And at the point in time that that happens, that might be very appropriate. However, as many of you know, federal laws change, state regulations change, and if that is missed, we can continue to charge to a program, even though from a point in time forward it might not be appropriate. And those are the kinds of things that we charge our internal auditors to look for.
Another question? Representative Fletcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the paragraph there, it talks about the $9.5 billion. I guess my question is, how much of the internal auditing goes to that amount of money? I'm thinking of the money that's contracted locally. Do we require our contractors to also do auditing? I'm just wondering, at what level does that stop when we pass the money along to the counties or nonprofit contractors or
this unit actually will go in and audit counties and AAAs and the nonprofit providers. Typically, we do that upon request of a program area. They may get a request from a program area where they may be concerned or there hasn't been a review in a while, and they would ask them to go into a certain county and audit a certain county program or a contract of a service provider, a nonprofit, or a contractor. And so they really will get down to that level, the actual on-the-ground program area auditing.
Thank you. I assume resources permitting.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that's correct.
Thank you.
Leading question.
And much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sturgeon. How'd you interrupt? You were at the end of your...
I was, Chair Carter.
Thank you.
Jim Scherzinger, Finance, Department of Human Services. I have just a two-page presentation on cost allocation, and then I think I can get to the questions that were just asked about the next POP. We put this two pages in about cost allocation because we've gotten a lot of questions about it. There is a lot of confusion around cost allocation and what its role in the department's finances are, and I want you to know there's a lot of reason for that confusion. One of the reasons is that it's complex. The book that has the cost allocation formula, and it fundamentally boils down to be a formula, takes up a book about the size of the book that you have in front of you, just to describe how it works. Now, many of you know that I've done a lot of work with the school funding formula. This is way more complicated than the school funding formula. So it's a complex formula, so there's confusion for that reason. The second reason is that it essentially is statistically, in many parts of it, are statistically re-estimated every month. So it changes month by month. And that is a source of confusion. And just the notion that you have statistics involved in it, I think, is enough to confuse most people. And a third reason, and it's more of a, I guess you would call it a conceptual confusion, is encapsulated in my first bullet, where I say that the Administrative Service Division is mostly funded through cost allocation, and I put quotes around the word funded. And the reason I did that is that cost allocation does assign costs to grants. You'll see that in a minute. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it provides the resources for that, whatever is being, quote, funded by that. You still have to appropriate funds. You still have to give limitations. And in some situations, the funding is sort of generated automatically by the allocation. In other situations, it's not. Just depends upon the characteristics of the grant. So to say that something goes into cost allocation means that it's funded isn't necessarily true. If there's no general fund appropriation to cover that cost, it's not funded, even though it's in cost allocation. So there's confusion around what does it really mean to be funded. All that cost allocation is really doing is allocating cost to grants, and whether there's ultimately money to pay for those costs is another question. Sometimes it's answered by the fact that it's allocated to a particular grant that is automatically funded. Sometimes it's not. It has to be appropriated general fund or whatever. So I think that's the third sort of conceptual confusion around cost allocation. Now, most ASD costs, and actually most salaries and administrative costs of the entire department are, quote, funded through cost allocation. So this is a pretty important process within the Department of Human Services. And I think the highest level, simplest way of expressing it, of how the formula works, is encapsulated in that little example on page 19, that little pie chart. Essentially what happens is that costs are allocated
grants. And as you know, the department has, I forgot now, about 1,400 grants or a huge number of grants within it. And what cost allocation does is, through a formula, allocate these costs to grants. And what's once allocated to a grant, the funding split, if it's federal funds or general funds typically, is determined by the characteristics of that grant. So once it goes to the grant, then whatever the split of that grant is determines how it hits federal funds or general funds, or actually other funds. You'll see in a minute how that works in here.
Who determines that?
It's determined by the by whatever the laws are. Maybe the federal law, maybe the way the state law is written, could be the conditions if it was a the condition of it may be a grant that we applied for, so could be the conditions of that particular grant, and we have a limit on administrative costs. Could be any of that conditions of the grant, wherever those conditions came from. So a real simple example that's important in ASD is the Medicaid Administration grant. If the costs are allocated to that Medicaid Administration grant, then under the terms of federal law, that's a 50-50 fund split between general fund and federal funds. But if it's the regular Medicaid grant, then it's the whatever the federal funding ratio, which is roughly 60-40, that would determine it. If it's the TANF grant, I know you've had a lot of discussion of TANF, we have a choice about it. We have a MO obligation we have to meet, and we have a limit on the amount of the federal grant, and we can make a choice of in any particular charge about whether to charge to general fund or to federal funds, depending upon where we are in meeting our MO obligation or where we are on using up our entire federal block grant. So within each grant, there is a certain set of conditions or choices that we have to make that ultimately would determine what the fund split that comes out of that is. Now, when you have a lot of grants like that, then you can see that it can get pretty complicated, and you can get lost in the mix of what's happening. In ASD, is largely, it says, a roll-up of allocations across DHS. And what I mean by that is maybe another simple example, something like the state government service charge. The state government service charge is funded by virtually every grant that we get. And the fund split is determined by rolling up those fund splits across the whole organization. So, for example, in the particular case of the state government service charge, it's allocated by personnel costs. So, for example, if you're an employee in CAF and you're funded by the TANF grant, and your fund split is a certain percentage, then your salary is going to roll up into all the salaries, personal service costs agency-wide, and that split, that grant split, and you're the TANF part of it, you're gonna be one element that pushes it more toward TANF on that department-wide allocation of the state government service charge. And then the fund split that happens there is going to be determined by whatever choice we make within ASD about whether to charge it to federal or general funds. So it's a roll-up of the grant splits across the entire department, in this case based on personal service costs, and then we make a choice if it's TANF grant about the fund split. If it were a Medicaid admin grant, it would be a 50-50 split by the way the law reads. So now let's see, what else do I have on here? Other funds. How do other funds come into this? Generally speaking, although it's not always true, the split is between federal funds and general funds as it runs through the cost allocation process. Charges that are posted against the general fund under cost allocation, though, can be replaced by other funds if a division has other funds to use. And typically the way that happens is that the charges are posted against the general fund. We get other fund revenues, tobacco tax, whatever it might be, and we can use that revenue to replace general fund spending. So that revenue will come in, we'll take those charges that have been posted to the general fund and we'll shift them over to other funds and cover them with the tobacco tax. And that's typically, not always the case, but typically the way that charges that are run through cost allocation might ultimately hit other funds. They first go to general funds, the revenue comes in on the other fund side, and those general fund costs are shifted over to that other revenue source. So you can see that adds another level of complexity.
Excuse me for a minute. Representative Garrard?
Hi, Jim. I'm confused.
This should be expected.
Earlier you said that cost allocation is not funded. Don't indicate a funding.
Right. It does not indicate that there is revenue to pay for those costs, yes.
But when you just made reference to charges posted by the cost allocation.
Right.
So if there's, where are you posting the charges to?
You would post them to the accounting system. So say, for example, payroll goes through for the administrative services division. So I get my paycheck, where it's a direct deposit actually, but I get my direct deposit. That charge or that cost is posted to the accounting system as an expense. And that expense goes through cost allocation, and a portion of that expense is put on every grant we've got virtually. And then that is split between general fund and federal funds based on the roll-up of all of those grants. And those charges are posted as charges on the system. So,
yes. Eventually there's got to be a charge to the general fund or
right.
from whatever fund allocation right. they're taken from.
A portion of it will be charged to the general fund based on that roll-up. And if we don't have the general fund authority, if we don't have an appropriation from you that could cover that cost, then we're in big trouble. Because we're going to have to come over to you and say we overspent our budget. So there has to be that authority there in order for us to post those expenditures. To the extent that it's something, a federal fund charge, we're primarily on a reimbursement basis with the federal government. The biggest chunk of our federal revenues comes through Medicaid, and if that's a legal posting, in other words, if we've done it correctly, and that's an eligible charge that posts to the system, then the very day that posts, we'll have somebody in the accounting section, Linda Lamb to be precise, who will draw the revenue from the federal government. She does it every day, and that revenue will then come in to cover the charge because we're on a reimbursement basis. And that's a pretty complex set of events, but that's how that will happen. If it's to a federal grant that has some other sort of limitation on it, then hopefully we're within all our limitations, or somewhere down the road somebody will audit us and say you charged something to something you shouldn't have, and we'll have to pay them back. But the federal government generally is on a reimbursement basis, so we post the charges and then draw the revenue. Okay. Now we also have to have enough limitation that the legislature has allocated on federal funds in order for us to do that as well. But that, generally speaking, is not an issue. It's usually the most important thing on federal funds is that these are legitimate charges, that they're eligible charges for that particular grant.
One final
please.
When you award a grant, Jim, where in the process are the funds released and the funds charged?
Released. When we get a grant or when we are giving a grant to someone else?
Let's say you have awarded a grant. Where in the process are the funds charged to the account? When you award the grant, or when the grant work has been completed?
Okay, so this is an entirely different situation, because what I was talking about is when we're receiving money from someone else.
I understand.
But when we award a grant, and Fairbourse can talk much better about this than I can, but I'll talk about the finance side. It has to go through all of the awards processes, you know, public procurement and all of that, and goes through all of that, and they set up a methodology for how that grants gets billed to us and under what conditions the contractor or the county or whoever is getting this money, how they bill us and what are the deliverables that have to be there that will pay, you know, you give us this deliverable, we pay you this amount. All of those are set out in the contract, and then when you fulfilled them, you send in a bill, you say, here's my product. The program has to say, yes, you've delivered the product, and then we pay the, just like any other state contract.
I've got the picture.
That's way oversimplified.
I have the picture.
All right, already.
Okay. Let's see, where were we? We talked about how other funds generally replace federal funds. The whole cost allocation system has to be approved by the federal government. And you can see why that is, because we're determining where our costs hit all these grants. And so every federal agency has some interest in first of all, whether or not we're overcharging the feds relative to our own agencies. And secondly, even within federal agencies, and sometimes we actually get caught in the middle, we're in one right now, where one federal agency thinks we're overcharging them and another one approved the allocation. So sometimes we get caught in the middle. There's a whole office of cost allocation that approves these things. So that's important, because it's not so easy to change this. There's a very long process for if we want to change the cost allocation process, and we actually tried to change it this time for a very good reason, and it wasn't approved this last couple months ago. Another thing to understand about this is that as a result of cost allocation, almost all of our positions, we have over 9,000 positions in the Department of Human Services, are split funded. And not only are they split funded, but the split can change every month because of cost allocation. So we have a devil of a time keeping up the PIC system. In fact, it's not very well kept up to be consistent with the cost allocation system, and it's a real systems issue that we need to resolve.
Take a look at Andrew. 9,000 employees,
right.
Most of them are on some kind of cost allocation.
Right.
That might even change many times during the course of 1 month.
Well, change every month. They get paid once a month by and large, and so it could. It doesn't change a lot, but it changes every month what those allocations are. It can change every month based on the statistical sampling that's done. But the key is that over time, the thing can move on you. And to keep PICs aligned with that, which is essentially a system where we have to enter each position in and the fund splits in, is difficult to keep up with. And that's been one of our budgeting problems over the last few years, has been keeping PICs aligned with how we actually are spending our funds.
Ms. Baker?
Madam Chair, indicate that that's why when you're doing the rebalance of the current biennium for the department, or when we get to the resheet, there will be a line item adjustment there, and it's usually referring to cost allocation, funding shifts due to cost allocation. And this is the whole reason, because it's the budget assumes certain cost allocation. It changes during the biennium, and then the department has to update its funding to reflect how it's actually being charged and how those funds are actually being expended.
Representative Garrett. Oh, we have to share that. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is very complicated, but we're not the only state that has more than one source of money that pays for these kinds of activities, federal funds and other sorts of sources.
are we unique or absolutely typical in the way we do this cost allocation?
I've been only here about a year, so I'm not that familiar with other states. My impression from the conversation is that we're not typical in the we're not unique in the sense that all states have some sort of cost allocation formula and struggle with these kinds of issues. I'm not sure that we know that all states, in fact, I'm pretty sure that many states use a more of a proximate method of doing it and don't use the same level of statistical techniques that we do. But I'd have to ask some of my more expert staff to correct me if I'm wrong on that. But that's my impression from having been there. But I think you're quite correct that all states face this, and that for a variety of reasons we'll talk about in a minute, we need to do better and can do better at estimating these things and getting systems in that will keep us up better than we have.
Brief follow-up.
Sure.
When I think about how complicated it is and the headaches that you go through, all the work and how many people it must take trying to get a handle on this, I start thinking about the cost benefit. Is there a way of doing an estimate that gets you pretty close, maybe not accurate down to the penny, but is it costing us more than we're gaining by maintaining such a complex set of formulas and where the numbers move around on you continually?
Well, I will, as we'll talk about in a minute, the process that we went through for the review team, the operations review team process, and that was one of the comments that they made. Can you look at simplifying cost allocation in the very direction that you suggested? And it is, that's a long-term process, as I said, to get federal approval of that. As I've started working through these issues in my own mind, I think that that's clearly an option, but the thing we have to weigh it against isn't just whether it actually, is purely a cost benefit in terms of how accurate it is, but it's also about how the impression of accuracy that that our approval authorities have over it. And I think that's as much a part of that calculation as whether it really is just as good or almost as good enough. Because the more that they view the process as being better, the less they're going to come around poking around, causing us to justify it every time. So I think there are pros and cons to it that are broader than simply whether or not, from a practical standpoint, we could come up with something just as good. You could also make an argument, and I've had this one, is that the more complicated it is, the harder it is to explain to all the other federal agencies that don't like the result, because we've had that issue as well, where they come in and even though the Office of Cost Allocations approved it, they don't like it because they think they're being overcharged, and then we have to explain something complicated. So I think you get into those kinds of discussions that get beyond whether or not there is another way to do it that's just as good.
Thank you.
But it is on our radar.
Representative Gerard, then Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, this is kind of like a black hole. You know, the further in you go, the more you realize you're. On the cost allocation formula, is that mandated by somebody, or is that some evil thing we devised ourselves?
We have to have some method of allocating costs, and there's actually a federal agency, Office of Cost Allocation, to approve these plans for each state. So we have to have one. Yes.
Okay. But the exact composition of that formula is up to us.
Yeah, that's correct. It has to be. They have to approve it, but it's our proposal.
One follow. Mm-hmm. So it could be changed.
It could be changed. It takes about a year.
But they'd have to agree.
Right.
Okay.
So there is hope. Yes. Actually, Representative Nathanson asked the questions that I was going to ask, but I could only add here that from my experience, the bureaucrats that we have on the state level are pikers compared to the bureaucrats that we have on the federal level.
She's so low key these days. That sounds more like a compliment.
I think that probably was a compliment. Madam Chair, I believe the department's going to take us, and this like segues into the next piece here, if I'm understanding what your questions are correctly and where you want to go with this discussion. And the very issues and questions you've been asking, I've been asking for 5 or 6 years and couldn't get a wrap around, and actually went out into the private world and started asking those questions. How do big corporations manage their money? How do they function? Why are they more successful than we are? And one of the reasons they're more successful, obviously, if they aren't successful, they go out of business. The state is not likely to go out of business. But the things that have been learned in running large organizations is what we're going to talk about, I believe, today. It answers the it really gets to the questions you're asking. 5 years ago, because of this, I happened to know somebody who was executive vice president of Lockheed Martin. His last budget was bigger than ours. His job for Lockheed Martin was to take care of the things you're talking about, to make sure that organizations and businesses are right-sized, that they run a lean organization, that they bring value for what they do. He's walked me through that process 3 times now, and I understand about half of it. It's very complex to change large organizations and make them successful. And those people who can do it get very large salaries, are paid very well. This man, John Ramsey, who I'm talking about, is retired now in Southern Oregon, came there because he wanted to live there, lived anywhere in the world, was brought back by Lockheed Martin for 3 more years to keep doing his job, and they flew him back and forth around the country. But he's now completely retired, and for reasons I don't completely understand, 4 years ago came up here with me and started talking to the department about how you change a massive program. He was not received with open arms. One time he came up the night before for a large meeting the next morning to find out when he walked in the meeting that it had been canceled. But under Dr. Goldberg's leadership, he's now been embraced, and I think this is what we're going to be talking about the rest of the way through here. This is a system that actually works, and many, many large companies use it very successfully to get to the problems you're talking about. And you're going to try to lead us through this in, what, 15 minutes? I've been out for 3 or 4 hours different times, and I just get confused. But
I'm going to say to my committee, I'm having a management problem.
Yeah, let's go forward.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment, because we were having a sidebar conversation, and while you were walking through this, I couldn't help but chuckle when I was grants manager for Children's Services Division, because one thing that we all, no matter what plan we come up with, and you said it, that you still have to get federal buy-off and approval, because the fact is that they're actually contributing the majority of the money, and they want to have the say. And states across the country would love, I think, to do what Senator Gates is talking about. We all have concepts of how we can do things a lot better, but some of the realities is if Mother in Washington, D.C. doesn't agree with us, or in Seattle, then we struggle with those concepts. So I just had to say that in case someone who's listening think that we have the authority just to do as we will.
How much more time is going to take you to wrap up?
On cost allocation, I just had one more thing.
Okay.
And that was to say, just as another example of how cost allocation affects our system, is that if we make a large payment in one particular month, it can have, because of cost allocation, some undesirable effects. So, for example, one of the things that we do is we pay the state government service charges for a whole year. And that's a big chunk of our budget. We make that payment in 1 month, and it hits all those grants in that month. And if there's something, if there is a grant out there that just happens to be ending that month or just beginning that month, wasn't around the rest of the year, it can get a disproportionate share, and you can have a grants manager screaming at you because you scarfed up a good chunk of their grant that month. So another thing about cost allocation is it's important to try not to have big things hitting it in a particular month. It works better the smoother the expenditures of the organization are. So that's the end of cost allocation. So I'm not sure. Do you want me to go on?
It's 2:20, but you could go on to Prop 10659 because Representative Garrard has already led you into a question on that.
Well, actually, the rest of a good part of the rest of the presentation for a while here is related to this POP, and let me just briefly talk about it, and then I guess tomorrow we come back and flesh it out. As Dr. Goldberg has talked about a number of times, probably every time he's been here, he's gone through a lot since he's been director on the financial side of the organization, trying to deal with some of the legacies of the reorganization of the department back in 2003. And this really begins back in 2003 when the divisions of the department were finally in the law integrated and centralized in one real department. And at the time that was done, things were centralized and they were brought together, but they weren't really integrated. We have lots of different processes. We still have 24 different payment and receiving systems in the department, but it's beyond the finances. It's just the way the department's operated. It just was not integrated to B1. It was on paper and when they come in here one, but just in terms of how it operated, it continued to operate based on the, in many ways, based on the rules of the past. And it wasn't able to put a lot of just redesign, reorganization into how the department would work. And where that really hit was on the finance side for a number of reasons. One was obviously the budget problems that the whole state had that put a lot of pressure on all of the agencies of state government. And that pressure translated into a lot of things happening on the financial side, really stressing that system, and things happening that got audit findings. Thought that we had a budget that, or we came in with budget shortfalls that we should have known about sooner, all kinds of things like that, many of you here were part of. And as Dr. Goldberg tried to deal with those things, one of the things that he did was to convene what was called an operations review team, experts from across both state government and the department. They came up with a series of recommendations to improve the finances of the department. And many of those have been implemented, and we've had a couple of advisory committees that have looked at those things, including one that some of you were on, have looked at those things. And as we've moved ahead with that, the next step of that, as the operations review team finished up its work, was to really look at how you change the entire culture of the department. And as Dr. Goldberg looked at that, and as he looked at what the private sector does in large organizations of this type, really settled on this notion of lean. And Fair Boards, when tomorrow, I guess, we'll talk about that. But the other thing that he learned out of that, well, there's two things. One is that we decided we needed to do a pilot in finance, since that's clearly one of our real difficult spots that needed improvement. So we're going to talk tomorrow about specifically what we've done in the finance side as a pilot. And so you'll get a sense of how this works from that. But secondly, that if we're going to improve the entire department and the processes in the entire department, which is what this POP is about, it's about the entire department, not just the finance sections, that we're going to have to invest some funds. And that's what the infrastructure investment POP 10659 is. just to add one more thing to answer the question about the internal audit, this POP is to improve the operations of the department. So it is to, and you'll get some hint of how that would happen tomorrow as we go through that, but it's to fix the operations. You still need, outside of that, a capacity of having someone come in when there is, when you do suspect that there might be something that isn't right, to come in and audit. And to say, are we really doing this right? So that's how these two are related, that this infrastructure investment is to improve the operations of the department. The audit function is something that exists outside of the operations that's independent, that can come in and you can point them to places where you think there may be high risk. You may hear that the feds are now looking at this across the country, so you're going to send your auditors in there to find out whatever problems we have before they do and fix them. But that's something that would exist that's independent, reporting to the director, that can come in and say, here's something that really needs to be fixed, and here's how to fix it. So I'd say that's the way you would see these two relate. So maybe I should stop there.
Just put on the record today, give us an idea what you're going to spend $5 million in professional services. Boy, oh boy, you better come up with a good one.
I think we can talk about it tomorrow. But let me just say, I don't want to leave you hanging. This is not a soap opera. I think it's largely to bring in people that are expert in implementing this kind of change in a large organization.
Okay.
And that's largely what the money would go for, but the director may want to say something about that.
You better have a gold tongue, I tell you that.
We'll see how good I am.
Okay.
You can look at this in two ways. You can look at this as a $5 million expenditure. I think what you'll see tomorrow is that what this is actually, I think, getting at exactly what Representative Girard is getting at. We have a tremendous amount of need. And you keep hearing in human services every day about all the need we have. And there's two ways to approach that. One way is to give more resources. And certainly, that is a huge piece of what's happening throughout the Ways and Means process, is putting more resources into delivering human services across the board. There's another side to it, and that's exactly what this piece is about. And what this is about is being able to use those resources more efficiently and more effectively to actually be able to get more service and to be able to provide more with the same amount of resource. So what this is just like an investment in information technology or whatever. This is a way of, and you'll see tomorrow, eliminating waste, bringing greater efficiency to what we do, so that actually we can provide additional service and more service with the resources that we have. This isn't what I would consider an expenditure as much as this is an investment in being certain we can do with what we have better, we can change the culture, we can operate more efficiently. And I think as we walk through that, you'll see some of the results we've already had in terms of finances, in terms of our ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's put a period there, and let's end with those themes, and the committee can ingest the themes so you can put it with the dollars tomorrow to see if that's the direction that you want to allow the department to go. Take in consideration that the House was in charge of human services the last time, and I respect the push forward that Representative Richardson and many of you that worked on this committee with Representative Morgan and serving during the interim on this. And so this is the kind of the people the department has acted in good faith in terms of direction they were being led from the last term. And so the reason I want you to really think about it, because I think that too many times we as a legislature spend money being
in the name of creative ideas from one term to the next term, and the department end up acting schizophrenic. And they're only acting as schizophrenic as we make them act, because we're the ones that's changing it every time. So I'm hoping that you will come back with a very open mind, and we'll have had some thoughts about this piece, 106.59. Thank you. With that in mind, we'll see you on tomorrow.